Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Hello, delighted to welcome our next guest, which is Professor Dominique Moran, who's a Professor of Carceral Geography at Birmingham University. So her expertise is in providing a geographical perspective on incarceration. Dominique was the first chair of the Carceral Geography Working Group of the Royal Geographical Society with the Institute of British Geographies and helped do the foundational work to set up this group. She's author of Carceral Geography, Spaces and Practices of Incarceration, and editor of a number of texts on spatial geography and its relation to imprisonment. She's also widely published in a number of leading geographical journals. So Dominique, very big welcome to you for coming along today.
Thank you for having me.
Dominique, your background is in geography. Can you tell us something about your career and how you came to be interested in carceral geography? What is it, for a start? And had you always planned to use your geography degree in this way?
Thank you very much. It's a great question. So I came to this in a sort of roundabout way. So I always wanted to do geography. I was always interested in people and spaces and why different places are different and the histories of them and so on. And I studied geography at Oxford. And the person who taught me there, Judith Palow, was the specialist in the geography of the former Soviet Union. So I was at Oxford between 1991 and 1995, which is obviously a really exciting time for the Soviet Union having just collapsed in 1991. And that's what I spent most of my undergraduate career studying. Then I did my PhD also with Judith Palow, and I was interested then in how people in the former Soviet Union were surviving in places where they'd settled during the Soviet period, but under them, the new market conditions were no longer viable places to live, really, really far away from sort of settled centres of population and so on. And I spent my PhD research in the north of Perm region, which is about a third of the way in to Russia, just before the Urals. Not Siberia, but not far away. And I spent my whole time looking at how people who lived in former forestry villages were surviving under the post-Soviet conditions. And, you know, the answer was that they were leaving or they were reverting to sort of subsistence farming and so on. But the areas that I spent my time working in turned out to have been places that people were resettled to under Stalin. So these were places where there had been forced labour in the 1950s and so on and leading up to that time. And they also had prisons in them, which had very recently closed. So I became quite interested in these, and it became a sort of small part of my PhD research. And then after that PhD, I continued to work with Judith Palow and with a criminologist, Lara Piacentini. And we did some work on understanding how women incarcerated in the Russian Federation in the contemporary period, how they were coping being incarcerated a really long way from home. Doing research in Russia is really challenging, and my Russian was never perfect by any means. And, you know, it became increasingly difficult to access Russia. Visas became quite challenging and so on. So I started to think, look, you know, there are prisons everywhere, and that's, I guess, what I'm becoming primarily interested in. So why don't I do some more research on these? And why don't I do it in places that I can get to and where I can speak the language already? This would make things much easier, right? So I sort of switched the research that I'm doing to look at geographies of incarceration in, you know, generally. And at the time, a number of geographers were starting to be interested in this, but there wasn't kind of a field of geography in the way that there's, for example, political geography and urban geography, which are kind of, it's clear what those things are. There wasn't a named area of geography that people who were working on this stuff could kind of call themselves and sort of feel part of. So I guess the name carceral geography sort of, for me at least, came about in that way of needing to call the work that I was doing and the work that I was doing with colleagues something that would make sense to the sort of academic geographical community more generally. So I suppose for me what carceral geography means is geography of confinement, of spatial confinement. It's about understanding in the way that human geographers, including me, are all interested in the ways in which people interact with spaces. I guess I'm, and the other people who do carceral geography, I'm interested in how people interact with spaces which confine them. so how people cope when they are confined in space. And I suppose maybe one of the differences between prison sociology and criminology and so on, which are also, I guess, interested in a fairly similar thing. The difference is, I suppose, that for carceral geographers, we're not so much interested in the reasons why people are incarcerated. We're interested in the experience of incarceration itself. So I suppose that's why many carceral geographers also work, for example, on migrant detention, and they work on other sorts of spaces of confinement, which are also of interest to criminologists, but which don't tend to be, I suppose, the core places that they work on. So I guess that's kind of how I came to this. It wasn't what I was intending, right? I was intending to carry on being a specialist in Russia and carrying on doing research there, but I guess interest and circumstances kind of steered me this way, and I'm pleased that they did.
Go on, Naomi.
I think that's a really interesting career path, actually. It was really interesting to hear that you started in Russia. And I was also thinking about the overlaps when you spoke about detention, for instance, for refugees. I'm wondering whether you feel that brings extra benefits to the perspective that geographers might bring to imprisonment for reasons of offending, whether you get different perspectives that you might not have arrived at if you were only focused on prisons.
Mm-hmm. I think it might do. So one of the things that we've been trying to do, I've been doing with my colleagues Jennifer Turner and Anna Schlier over the last few years, is trying to understand sort of what we mean by carceral, what this term signifies, and particularly what it means for carceral geographers. And I suppose we've kind of arrived at a number of conditions or sort of circumstances that we think are carceral, which are all about sort of the experience of confinement in space from the perspective of the people confined in it. And of course, I appreciate that migrant detention is associated really strongly with a criminalization of migration practices generally, and very often people are held in facilities which were prisons and have been converted into them, or which are run along the same lines as prisons and so on. And I suppose this is borne out in lots of the research that carceral geographers do in those spaces, where they find that people feel as if they're being punished, and they're experiencing incarceration in quite similar ways to the ways in which people who've been incarcerated for sort of quote-unquote crimes or more conventional crimes. But I guess one of the differences, and I suppose this comes through, for example, in the work of Mary Bosworth, and I'm sure that you know about, around sort of how people who've been incarcerated or who've been confined in these detention facilities but don't have, in the same way as people who've been conventionally incarcerated at a release date that they can kind of work towards and think is coming, how actually some of those experiences might be, you know, worse in some ways than the kind of conventional incarceration that we might be used to. But yes, I think this perspective maybe does bring, I wouldn't say completely different angles, because I think, you know, there's excellent work going on in lots of disciplinary areas, but I suppose the spatial focus, which is what's of prime interest to us, perhaps does bring a different look on things.
Thank you.
I was terribly interested to hear about your connection with Russia. I'm also in Oxford, and There used to be, I don't know if there still is, an exchange program with PAM, which my wife was involved with for a short period. Mm-hmm. And we also had a small organisation which connected with people in Minsk and south of Minsk, relating to the after effects of the Chernobyl disaster. Mm-hmm. And I went over to Minsk, I think it was twice. It was again in the early 90s, so terribly interesting, that sort of period between desperation and hopelessness, where everyone was very invigorated by developments. But
yes, the Oxford Perm Exchange was the reason that I went there in the first place. Yeah, absolutely.
Small world. Mm-hmm. Anyway, to get back to the task at hand, we came across your recent research into green spaces in prison on social media had got a fair bit of attention in the national press. Can you tell us a bit about that research?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Yeah. So this research into green spaces and their potential well-being effects in incarceration came out of some research that I've been doing for quite a long time now with Yvonne Dukes and also with Jennifer Turner. And we've been looking jointly at the impact of the design of prisons on the well-being of people who live and work in them. And in that work, we've been trying to think about what the characteristics of carceral environments are and what difference the characteristics of those environments might make to the lives of people who live and work in them. And primarily, we were really interested in the buildings and how they were designed, commissioned, engineered, and so on. But as part of that research, we spoke to a lot of incarcerated people and staff who work in prisons in Scotland, particularly, and in Scandinavia. And what became really clear was that green spaces were quite important for people. They talked a lot about losing, for example, the memory of what grass smells like, not having walked on grass for a really long time, missing trees, not having a sense of how the seasons were passing because they didn't see, you know, the leaves falling from the trees or flowers blooming and so on. And these things, which maybe appeared initially quite trivial, seemed, you know, because they happened so often and people talked about it so much, we thought, you know, this is quite an important thing. So the piece of research that I did subsequent to that work with Yvonne and with Jennifer, I did in collaboration with Phil Jones and Amy Porter at the University of Birmingham and our colleague Jacob Jordan at Utrecht in the Netherlands. And we essentially decided to see if we could find a way to, I suppose, quantify the effect of green spaces. So up until now, pretty much all of my research has been qualitative interview-based research. And in speaking to the Ministry of Justice, for example, and other organisations of that type around the world, they're interested in the work which comes out of that qualitative methodology, but they quite often ask a kind of follow-up question about, well, how do we know how much difference these green spaces will make? Can you prove that green spaces are causing, you know, A or B, and how much green space do we need, and so on. So I thought, you know, if there's a way in which we can put numbers onto this, maybe that will help. Perhaps that will be more persuasive than just the kind of qualitative research. And I understand that question which comes back from policy makers, because they're making very difficult and expensive decisions about how prisons should be. And I understand, you know, that most qualitative research comes from perhaps one or two establishments, and they reasonably ask, you know, how transferable are these findings. So what we did then in this latest piece of research was use GIS, geographical information systems, to draw upon ordnance survey data, which we're very fortunate to have at a very high resolution for the UK, to essentially calculate the percentage of a prison's envelope, which was what the term that we give to the area enclosed by the exterior wall or fence, the percentage of that area which is green, which is vegetated. And the reason for using this data set is because it can distinguish between kind of real grass and astroturf and so on, and it isn't fooled by things that to the naked eye might look like green spaces but aren't. So we calculated the percentage of green space within the prison envelope for all closed prisons in England and Wales. We didn't do the category D estate because it's not always clear kind of where those prisons start and end, and also because the people who are incarcerated in them obviously by definition spend some time outside, and of course we couldn't really control for where they were going and what they were being exposed to in those spaces. So we looked at the whole of the closed estate, and we calculated then, or Jacob did the maths, to establish if there's a relationship essentially between that percentage of green space and the published levels of self-harm and violence between prisoners and violence against staff, which takes place in those places. And in order to make these calculations as robust as we could, we also controlled for anything else about the establishments that we thought might influence the levels of self-harm and violence. So, for example, the size of them, the level of crowding, the category, the gender, whether these were sex offender specialist prisons or not, the age of people, in other words, are they white OIs or the adult estate. We also looked at whether the prisons were purpose-built or if they were part of one of the establishments which was kind of converted from an RAF base or a stately home or, you know, something else, of which there's more more than I thought that there were. And having done all of that, we find that there's a robust statistical relationship that shows that increased green space in prisons reduces violence and self-harm. And it's a quite strong relationship. And, you know, we thought that this was quite an important finding. I have to say that it's what we thought that we'd find, right? Because all the research which has been done in different institutional contexts, in hospitals and schools and so on in the past, demonstrates that there's this link, that green space is good for well-being in all kinds of ways. So this is kind of what we thought that we'd find. And also, I guess, based on the interviews which I'd conducted in the past with colleagues speaking to incarcerated people who talked about their feelings about losing access to green space, and if they had green spaces, how much they valued them, it's what we thought that we'd find. I don't think we thought the relationship would be as strong as it is. And I've certainly found in conversations with the Ministry of Justice more recently, whom of course I shared that research prior to it coming out in press, because that can take, you know, quite a long time. They were certainly interested in it and said, you know, it's handy to have figures which sort of demonstrate this relationship to go alongside the qualitative data that we'd had until now.
Fascinating. Were you able to show a kind of cost benefit to that as well?
Not really. So what we were able to do was to give a sense of the cost of levels of self-harm and violence. In other words, for example, we found some data which, and I can't recall what these figures are, unfortunately, but there was a figure for how much each hospitalisation or each hospital treatment of somebody who has self-harmed would cost. And that's for somebody who's not having to be escorted there by staff, of course, in cuffs and so on. This is just the cost of somebody being treated in hospital for self-harm. And of course, you know, if you multiply that figure up by how much self-harm is happening in prisons, and particularly how many incidents of self-harm require hospital treatment, anything which I guess can bring those costs down would be a good thing. And we also had some data about the cost of litigation from both incarcerated people and prison staff who've been subject to violence inside prisons, and of course those figures are high too. But I think, I guess, we looked at those figures for the costs because, you know, maybe, and I suppose we were thinking about the international applicability of this research, maybe in other jurisdictions prisoner well-being is not particularly high up on a policymaker's, you know, list of things to care about. I think it's different in the UK, at least I hope that it is. But I suppose we were interested to demonstrate that even if you don't, you know, care about prisoners' well-being, perhaps you ought to care about the cost of self-harm and violence, and of course also the cost of sick leave for staff who encounter high levels of tension and stress, and being in those environments, witnessing prisoners' emotional distress, self-harm and violence. So I think we were trying to sort of, I guess, tick two boxes there and say that if you're motivated by prisoner well-being, which I think that we should be in general, these findings are important. But even if you're not, you know, there's a cost which goes along with this that perhaps as taxpayers we ought to be mindful of.
It's so fascinating. It also reminds me of, there's some research, quite a bit of research actually, that's found that when hospital patients can see greenery from inside, they recover a lot faster. And I think it'd be far too complicated to look at, but you wonder whether people who are in prisons where there is a lot of green space, whether they might engage in a more proactive way with attempts to rehabilitate them, for instance, whether there could be further costs in that way. But I can't imagine that being a simple job to try and factor.
You're right, and I think it's that kind of research about the benefits of green spaces in hospitals and so on which was, I suppose, the foundation for why we tried to do this research, in thinking that, you know, these findings from these other environments, why wouldn't they transfer prison? But of course, why wouldn't they? Doesn't wash, you know, you have to kind of prove that they do. But I think you're right, and I suppose what I'm saying, or what we're trying to suggest with this research, is not that green space fixes everything, right? And that we don't really fully understand the causal relationship in between the presence of green space, viewing or experiencing green space, and feeling better or having well-being effects. We think, and most research which is going on into sort of how into understanding this, most research suggests that there's a sort of calming effect, that green space reduces stress, and that if people are in a less stressed state, then exactly as you say, Naomi, they're kind of better placed to engage positively, perhaps with the interventions which are on offer for them. They're in a better position to reflect and feel calm and feel better about themselves and think about what they might do with their lives and so on, rather than if they're in a highly stressed state, when really all that one can think about then is how to get through this day and how to, you know, survive short term. And I completely understand that's what most, I guess, a lot of people who are incarcerated feel like, and I guess it would be better if they didn't feel that way. Now, of course, there's a lot more to it, and individual circumstances, of course, will play an enormous part here. But I suppose we're trying to understand, I guess, how the environment affects people's well-being, and especially trying to understand the effect of green space.
So you're suggesting really that having a site of a green space can be beneficial, as well as being able to be out on it.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the next steps in the research, isn't it, to try to understand what dose of green do we need, and how does that dose need to be experienced? You know, is it? I think generally people in the wider field who research the impacts of green space feel that it's the getting out into these green spaces, the experiencing them for real, which is the best thing. But they're also quite sort of firm on the fact that even if you can't get out into green spaces, seeing them is beneficial. So that means like a view from a window or something. But even if you can't do that, then surrogate green spaces or sort of vicarious views are good too. So that means nature, images, even watching nature scenes on TV and so on. There's a really interesting study by Nalini Nadkarni and her colleagues from the US, which has demonstrated that for otherwise solitary confined prisoners in the US, viewing nature videos has been demonstrated to have a positive effect on them in terms of their feelings of well-being and so on. So, and I did a short piece of research looking at the impact of whole wall nature images at a prison in the UK, and found there that people, you know, spoke quite evocatively about the effect of these pictures and being able to sort of lose themselves in them and feel as if they were, for the period that they were looking at these pictures, not in prison. They could kind of place themselves in those pictures and feel, you know, the air, the fresh air on their cheeks, and hear their dog barking and so on and so on, right? So I think there's something in access to green spaces in whatever form is possible, I guess, within whatever environment someone's in.
Yeah, we collaborated with a local filmmaker to make some nature-based mindfulness films which could be viewed through a VR headset. Mm-hmm. And we did start trying to evaluate them, but of course then the pandemic arrived, and because of the need for contact with with them, that didn't come to a conclusion. But the people who were using them certainly seemed to appreciate that opportunity. And also I've seen research where even having a plant in the room is seen as being beneficial. But my experience is maybe it's just the prison that I've worked in, but there's quite a lot of resistance to enabling green space that people who live in prisons have access to. And I remember starting in Whitemore in 2003, and obviously high secure hospitals, the patients do get to access green space, they get to do gardening, but actually talking about wanting to enable the men in the unit to be able to engage with green space, it was like we were suggesting something that was really dangerous, that they might secrete items. And actually the only reason we ended up with a garden, I think, was because some officers became really passionate about growing a herb bed in order to have herbs for cooking, and they worked really, really hard over a very long period to persuade security that this was a risk that could be managed. And then once it was established and people could see actually it is quite safe and there's a benefit to it, they were later able to grow flowers in it, which again, you know, which really brightened up a concrete exercise yard, which was the only access to fresh air that the men had prior to that.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, it's nice to hear that that's how that ended up. And I think you're right, and I've certainly heard a lot of people's fears about what's the risk of this and what might happen. And I completely understand that these are difficult environments to manage and people have to weigh up risk and so on. And I suppose what we were trying to do with the recent piece of research is go a little way towards demonstrating the benefits in a way that is sort of robust and transferable and draws upon a wide range of data rather than just kind of one establishment, so that when people are weighing up that risk, they at least have something on the other side of the scale to say, well, look, you know, we know that it's going to have this effect on self-harm and violence, and perhaps that's, on balance, perhaps that's a risk that we are willing to take in order to, you know, manage whatever risk there might be of things being secreted and so on.
It's a sad reflection of society as well, I think, that when Joe Public's thinking about prisons, they don't think, I mean, for me, if I think about what it would be like to be in prison, it's things, basic things like physical contact, or being able to go out on a sunny day like today and walk on the grass and feel the fresh air and everything. And actually Joe Public's not really thinking about that. They're thinking about televisions and access to games consoles. Mm-hmm. So in a way, providing more green space can improve quality of life in a way that's quite risk-free for policymakers, because mm-hmm. Joe Public's not really thinking about whether people in prison have got access to green space or not. So they could do quite a lot without suffering the backlash in the tabloid press, it seems to me.
I think you're right, yes. And I think, you know, I suppose, how can I put this? It's difficult to know what Joe Public really thinks, right? Because it's really difficult to articulate the question, to find a sort of, to get a response that isn't already sort of led towards a particular answer. And I think in a lot of the research that Yvonne Jukes and Jennifer Turner and I did, we were sort of asking people who designed and commissioned prisons why they designed them as they did. And they frequently said to us, you know, we've been told in their various contexts, we can't make this too nice, because, you know, the public won't stand for that. It can't look too much like a holiday camp. They can't have it sort of too nice. And we were always interested in, like, why is this, and what is too nice, and what exactly does, you know, the public think that a prison ought to be like, and how do we know? You know, and I did a piece of research with a master's student at Birmingham, Lucy Echegoyen, and she used the prison simulation game Prison Architect, which is, you know, a computer game. And she spoke to a number of people all over the world who built virtual prisons using that game. And her purpose in doing this was to understand, within the sort of game mechanics, which, you know, lead you to do certain things to win points and so on, what kind of prisons did people build and why? And we were amazed to find that even when the game mechanics would steer you towards being a quite punitive prison manager and kind of packing people in as tightly as you could, and, you know, not caring about their well-being, people still wanted to introduce green spaces. They wanted to treat people what they would consider to be humanely, even when it meant that they lost out in the game. And we were really surprised by that, thinking that actually maybe the public, you know, I mean, this is obviously a small sample of largely young men, because that's largely who plays this game, right? But they didn't act in the way that we thought that they would. And when she spoke to them about why they had designed prisons as they did, they often said, look, you know, when I've looked at this, and if I've been playing it for so long, I start thinking, this isn't right, you know. I shouldn't have even virtual people in these spaces, so I'm going to give them windows, I'm going to give them green spaces, and I'm going to spread them out more, even when there was no benefit.
Fascinating.
It was fascinating. So I think there's quite a lot of further understanding that we need to get at around what does, you know, the public want. Because I think maybe for politicians there's a sort of easy, well, they want to see people punished, they want revenge, they want prisons to be harsh and tough and so on. But I think people are cleverer than that. I think they understand that actually if you treat someone really, really badly, they're not going to come out of prison a better person and less likely to commit more crime than they went in. And so why would we think that this works, right? So I think there's a lot in that, but I'm sure that you're right, you know?
Yeah, that's, I mean, we're really interested in these things which make a kind of marginal benefit. But one of the difficulties, as I see it, is that things in within prisons or the prison system are so fragile, and by that I'm meaning really the cultural environment. So if nothing is absolutely fixed, then it can be changed. I was thinking that I used to work at Grendon Prison, and one day we had a new security governor arrive who looked at all the mature shrubs and bushes that were around and decided they were a risk. And so he had them all cut down and removed. But another example is that to set up and establish the therapeutic communities in prisons, they had to write what they called a prison service order, which is like a law within the prison service. And the PSO said TC should be like this, and they've continued. So I suppose my question about that is, do you have a strategy for influencing policy and getting it embedded?
Do I have a strategy? Gosh, that's a good question. Not really. So I haven't got a sort of point by point plan. I guess I was very, very fortunate a few years ago to be approached by the late Dr. Ruth Mann, who'd come across my work and was interested to see if there were benefits from it, or if there were kind of lessons which could be learned from it for the team who were going to take over at the new HMP Berwyn, which at the time was still under construction. So I spoke with her and with that team about this work, and especially about green spaces, and I hope, you know, that some of those lessons were kind of taken forward. I know that they have quite a bit of green space, and they have those large nature images internally. And then through Dr. Mann, I was introduced to a number of prisons, individual prisons, and I spoke to the Ministry of Justice Estates Directorate several times with Yvonne Dukes too. And I suppose it's sort of grown a bit organically in that, you know, this is a big organisation with lots of different parts to it, and I suppose people's connections and so on pass on names and interesting things sort of in between them. So I've been to a number of prisons and spoken to governors who've been interested to see what can be learned and what might change at a local level, and it's always a privilege to have those invitations and to kind of go in and have a look at prison environments and suggest, you know, what how things might be different and what the opportunities might be at, you know, a reasonable cost to change things. And I suppose it's through those conversations really that it's become really clear, and I guess, you know, once more, the reason for approaching this recent piece of work in the way that we did, that people find it difficult to argue themselves for the funding that they would need to make the changes they want to make if the research underpinning it isn't of the type, I suppose, that people might automatically find the most persuasive, which I guess means numbers, hence coming about the research in this way. But I guess, you know, a strategy, perhaps I should get one. I've kind of just let things take place as they will thus far. But you're right to say that the social media and the media reception for the recent piece of work definitely did open up a number of doors. And there are a number of people who work in pastoral geography whose sort of institution of interest is the psychiatric hospital. But as far as I'm aware, they haven't taken forward research into green spaces in those environments. I think what's really interesting, though, about that question is sort of the assumption that lies underneath the research that I've been doing and that colleagues have been doing in different environments, that although it talks about the benefits for people, it doesn't disaggregate those people according to their own personal characteristics. Mm-hmm. So we don't know, for example, very much about the differential effects of green spaces on women as opposed to men, on young people and so on. And as far as I'm aware, there's not very much research at all on the benefits of green spaces, or indeed other aspects of the environment, on people who have a different way of mental functioning to, I suppose, mm-hmm. what we might think of as, you know, the norm, whatever that is. And I think that's really important. I think that research is what we need to be doing next, because I think, I guess, people who work in these environments understand really well that people are triggered by different things in the environment around them, sort of perceive the environment differently, have heightened sensitivity perhaps to sound and light and colour and so on, and perhaps we need to be a bit more sensitive. Well, I'm sure that we need to be a bit more sensitive to the neuro divergencies that people have when thinking about what the impact of the environment is. And I guess what I hope is that through the work that we've been able to do in demonstrating that there is this link in general, that further research might be done by colleagues in thinking through kind of how are those effects taken forward in different people based on the different characteristics they have. I think it's a really, really important area, and I suppose if it's the case, which I guess that it would be, just, you know, based on the prior research that's happened, that green spaces are calming and so on, then I suppose that they would be a useful component of psychiatric hospitals.
Yeah, I think it'd be really, because really interesting. I think hospital staff are often more aware of, and maybe it's because there's a bit more freedom. So, you know, even patients who are detained under the Mental Health Act generally have some ability to access under supervision green space with some degree of frequency. And, you know, in a prison, access to fresh air might just be a concrete yard surrounded by brick walls, whereas in a hospital that's highly unlikely. Usually it would involve something that more resembled a garden, so you would hope for a better quality of interaction with green space. But even so, it seems to me like something that might be possibly intuitively done rather than researched to really consolidate the knowledge base around the therapeutic benefits of access to greenery.
That's right. I'm sure you're right there. Yeah.
I think we've all come to appreciate the benefits of having access to green space over the course of the last 12 months during the pandemic. Were you someone who was greatly appreciative of nature before then?
Yeah, I was, absolutely. So from being a small child, our family holidays would always be camping on some Scottish or Irish island. My dad was a very keen bird photographer, so we spent all of our summer holidays doing that. And I've been brought up, you know, watching David Attenborough on TV and so on. So I guess I've been very fortunate to have been brought up in that way and have had access to green spaces and so on. And I absolutely, you know, I would fall in with people who've really appreciated their gardens and their house plants and green spaces and so on under the lockdown. And I definitely tended my garden much more carefully over this past year, and it shows, you know, stuff grows if you care for it. So absolutely.
I know it's quite hard to see people that were stuck in flats, high-rise flats with no access to green space, wasn't it? And then kind of like some of the public backlash about them sitting in parks, and you think, God, it's very easy to be in lockdown if you've got a nice garden to sit in and have some access to fresh air.
Yeah.
So along with green space, blue space and the sea is also known to be therapeutically beneficial. Are there any prisons? Well, I suppose there is actually the cluster of prisons on the Isle of Wight. They're in I don't know how close they are to the sea. Mm. And I wondered whether you'd explored whether that had any therapeutic benefits.
Mm-hmm. I have, yes. So as part of a research project with Yvonne Dukes and Jennifer Turner, we conducted some research at HMP Grampian up in Peterhead, which is right on the sea. It's an incredible location. And a number of the cells overlook the sea and have this stunning view. Some of them don't, of course, and they look inland. And some of the questions that we asked of people incarcerated there and the staff who work there are how significant that blue view was and whether people looked at it and so on. And as you would imagine, lots of people said that it was a really important part of their daily life, that they loved to watch the sun going down over the sea. They could see the oil rigs sort of far out to see they'd seen whales, dolphins and so on, and that having the sea there was a really important part for them, and, you know, the sound of it to an extent. Also the freshness of the air coming off the sea. Mm-hmm. Some people also said that it was troubling for them that they found, and I guess especially when they were looking across the bay to the populated area of the town and they could see sort of parties and people, you know, enjoying themselves and so on, that was difficult. And that they often would sort of pull down their blind or close the blind so that they couldn't see it. but definitely people talked about kind of using that blue view to reflect, sort of letting their mind wander whilst they looked at the sea and kind of getting into a calm state. And that really bears out some of the theoretical research into the significance of, I guess, primarily green spaces, but spaces which have, or views which have depth and which have interest and which allow the mind, I suppose, to wander and rest. And of course, you know, the sea is, of course, one of those. In the research that we did most recently into the green spaces, in which we calculated, you know, these green spaces, we also calculated the characteristics of an area immediately outside the prison walls or fences to see if the presence of green space, or sorry, of blue spaces made any difference there. Effectively, we found not much of a benefit. And I suppose that's because, A, there's not very many prisons in England and Wales which have, within the buffer zone that we used, green spaces, blue spaces. And I suppose also that in most cases, even if blue spaces were there, people wouldn't frequently have a view of them because of the height of the wall or fence and the location of their cell within the complex. But I think where there is a blue view, it's very likely that it has this effect, and that the things that we found at Grampian would I guess be commonly the case. And I think there's some research which, you know, or people have talked about people who are incarcerated at Alcatraz who looked at the sea and so on, yeah. who claimed that they could hear, you know, the tinkle of champagne flutes on, you know, the beach being blown, you know, towards them and so on. I think there's a lot of sort of myths about the sea which play out in these environments, especially when we have prisons on islands.
Yeah, I wonder as well, as you know, if you think about the green space, if it's outside the perimeter of a prison, it probably comes with associated increase in wildlife, insects, birds and so on, which presumably at times venture into the prison, whereas I suppose with blue space you might get that less, apart from the sound of maybe seagulls, for instance. But maybe the transfer of nature into the prison environment is less extensive.
I think you're right. So in that piece of research that we did, that's the third paper which will come out of the green space data set work, we did find for green spaces outside of the prison wall almost exactly the same benefits to people who are incarcerated in those facilities. And I guess there we were interested to learn something about how prison location might affect well-being. So up until now, the research which has been done on inter-prison location and its importance primarily looks at the local communities who live nearby the prison, and for example their fear of crime or their fear that their house price will fall because there's a new prison, the kind of NIMBY responses. It doesn't tend to think about the impact of that location on the well-being of the people who are incarcerated, apart from, which is really important, their distance from family and friends and therefore the likelihood of getting visits. So we were interested to see whether the location of a prison in green space made any difference, and we found that it did. But then that opens up, exactly as you say, a question of, well, why? You know, how is green space that people perhaps can't see influencing them? And that's a question that's really significant for the wider sort of green space and well-being research, because most of that research tends to be predicated on the fact that people can see the green spaces that we are theorising have an effect on them. But if they can't, for example, if there's a high wall around prisons, or if only people on the higher levels could see over that wall, if they can't see those green spaces, why might they be having a benefit? And of course, we came up with the same things that that you just said about insects, bird life, perhaps the freshness of the air, perhaps the quality of sound, perhaps there's something here. We haven't got the answers to that, but we're hoping that through publishing, which we hope to do, those findings that will suggest to other people who have specialisms in those areas that perhaps this is something that's worth looking into.
I know you also mentioned the impact on staff absenteeism as well, in terms of understanding there's an impact on staff wellbeing. But I was thinking that in some ways, kind of like evaluating impact on staff might be easier. So wondering about, we know that staff do their job in a more compassionate way when they feel compassionately dealt with themselves. And I suppose a measure of whether staff feel they are cared for and valued by their employer might be an interesting way to go in terms of the access to green space, mightn't it?
Definitely, yes. I mean, the second paper which comes out of this green space data set was looking at as closer as we could get to a proxy for staff well-being. So that kind of data that you're talking about, I think, would be really, really important. But unfortunately, that wasn't anything that we could access. What we could access was prison staff sickness absence. Now, of course, within sickness absence is collected a whole pile of different things, from actual sickness to sort of feeling as if you've lost, enthusiasm for work, just, you know, having an off day, you know, just sort of things which I guess collected together we might consider to be a proxy for a lack of well-being. And we ran the same statistical tests for prison staff sickness absence as we had for prisoner self-harm and violence and so on, and found the same thing, that green spaces reduced prison staff sickness absences. Even when we controlled for all the same stuff, the size of establishment, we also included in staffing levels. For example, if staff might feel that a prison was understaffed, perhaps that meant that they were off sick more. And we also controlled for prisoner self-harm, prisoner against prisoner violence, and violence versus staff. And even when we controlled for all of those things, we found that green space still had an effect. So I think, you know, exactly what we thought that we'd find, we did find. But I think your point about feeling as if they're treated compassionately is really important in a broad sense. So, and this is, of course, really difficult to measure with stats, but in interviews with people incarcerated in the UK and in Scandinavia, people often said that even if they didn't like what had been done in their particular establishment in terms of the colour or the nature images or the gardens or, you know, whatever, or even if they weren't bothered by it, the fact that somebody had cared enough to try was a significant thing of itself. That, you know, even if they don't like it, the fact that they've tried to do this means that they do care about our well-being. They do think that we're, you know, we're better than the animals that we might otherwise feel like if we've been incarcerated in a very kind of austere and harsh environment, and that had a benefit of itself. Really, really difficult to quantify, but I think that's definitely there.
Great, thank you very much. Just going back to the issue around blue space, it reminded me that I visited Warren Hill prison last year, which is within a couple of hundred yards of the sea. Although while I was there, I didn't have any particular awareness of that. Perhaps if I'd gone a bit further down the road, I would have bumped into it. But nevertheless, Warren Hill does have exceptional facilities, including a project for raising and looking after raptors, hawks and other kinds of birds. Very interesting place to go to.
Mm-hmm. It sounds it.
Yeah. So moving on, you've also written about the visit spaces in prisons and the implications for connections between people in prisons and their families. Can you say a bit more about that?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So this was a piece of research that I was doing prior to the work on prison design and green spaces. But I was interested in the finding that of, you know, the range of different interventions that are provided or offered to incarcerated people, having visits from family and friends tends to be one of the things that has an effect on reoffending. And this effect on reoffending occurs really whenever we look for it in all different contexts, in all different sort of time frames. And I was interested in how the spaces in which visits take place affect the quality of those interactions, and then perhaps the effect that they might have on reoffending. So I did some work with my colleague Marie Hutton, looking at people's experiences of visits and trying to understand how, for example, things which might seem a bit mundane, like the spacing of tables, the height of tables and chairs and so on, affected the ways in which people could speak to one another in those rooms. And again, you know, the things that we found might seem quite obvious and kind of common sense, but we found quite often that people were being spaced further apart during their own visit than they were in terms of their proximity to other visits. So for example, there'd be low chairs, a low coffee table that you couldn't lean on, and you couldn't get your knees under. And of course there's reasons for that in terms of not passing things under tables and so on. But it meant that because the visitors' chairs were kind of back to back with somebody else's chair, they were much nearer a person they hadn't come to see than the person they were actually trying to speak to. And the chairs were often plastic covered, which meant they got a sweaty bum while they're sat there for quite a long time. And especially the incarcerated person couldn't stand up, so couldn't sort of make themselves more comfortable. Everyone felt as if they had to perch on the edge of this chair and kind of lean right forward, and that's fine for sort of 10 minutes or so, but if a visit is 45 minutes longer, it gets uncomfortable and people started to fidget, and then they started to worry that the fidgeting would be interpreted by the person they'd come to see as their boredom, or that they didn't want to be there, and so on. So actually, the spacing of tables and chairs, well, although it seems a really banal and mundane and kind of unimportant thing, was really important for how people felt able to conduct themselves and how they felt able to show their caring for somebody else, and that they were engaged in the conversation, and that this conversation was a good one, and that they were both, you know, getting emotional sort of support from that conversation. And of course, visit rooms are often, you know, have hard, shiny floors, hard, shiny walls, not a lot of sort of soft surfaces in there. The sound bounces around a lot. They're really noisy places. And quite often, people in those environments don't want to shout about their personal life, especially if they know that the person sitting behind them can hear even better than the person they are talking to. And that means that perhaps things which need talking about, for example, the future of relationships, children's well-being and so on, don't get talked about in that environment. And then those things become an issue that hasn't been dealt with, and that everything is left until the person who's incarcerated has been released. And then there's a lot to work through, which perhaps is difficult then in those circumstances when it hasn't been talked about for so long. So I think this stuff that seems perhaps, you know, fairly trivial and unimportant, I think we were really struck by actually how important this stuff was, and how important the level of comfort of the seating, the acoustic treatment and quality of the room would be for enabling people to have the best kind of interactions they can have. Now, that's not to say, obviously, that every visit is positive. Sad things happen, sad news is passed across, relationships end. Not all visits are great, right? But at least if the conditions in which they can take place are as good as they can be, then perhaps those interactions can be as supportive and as positive as possible.
I think it's great you're doing this really thoughtful work about situations which otherwise perhaps we don't get to think about. And certainly the experience I've had of many visits rooms is that they're very bleak, particularly when they're empty. Of course, they get imbued with life when people coming in, especially when there are children there. But nevertheless, all the kind of things that you've just described are still there, pressing in upon the people who are trying to have a brief emotional encounter. So thanks very much for that. You've also been working on understanding the experience of former military personnel working in prisons. Can you say anything about your findings there?
I can a bit, yeah. So that research came about really as a sort of side shoot from the research that I've been doing with colleagues over a number of years, which had involved interviewing a lot of staff, prison staff. And, you know, when you're speaking to somebody, the first sort of couple of questions would always be, you know, how long have you been doing this for, and how do you come to be here? And I was struck by how often they'd say, well, I was in the army, and then, well, I was in the, you know, Navy or whatever, and then. And I always thought, this is interesting. How important is that? But the conversation could never go that way, because that wasn't what we were doing. So I thought, this is important, right? Because there's a lot of people with this background who've had these experiences. And as far as I was aware, it hadn't been researched ever, really. There'd been a kind of nod to it in criminological work of saying, you know, perhaps people with a military history aren't the best ones to do this kind of job. Perhaps they're more violent, more punitive. Perhaps they have a particular way of doing things which isn't beneficial for the prison service. But at the same time, there seems to be an awful lot of them. So they must be having a role, and, you know, something about their experience must be valued. So with my colleague Jennifer Turner, and with Helen Arnold as well, we wrote a paper which sort of suggested that this might be of interest for future research, and that perhaps the military service of prison staff was something that hadn't been focused on, and perhaps it should be, and perhaps, you know, we ought to care more about what the influence of this service is. So we've started some research in the UK through online surveys and so on, and then we branched out with Rose Ricciardelli to do some work in Canada, and we hope with Anna Erickson to do some work in Australia as well, looking at the percentage of people, as far as we can tell, who have this background. And as far as we can tell, in the UK prison service right now, it's about 1 in 4 prison staff who have who've served in the military. Now, that's the lowest level that it's been for some time, but at points in the past, as far as we can tell from speaking to former prison staff, it's as many as 3 in 4. Now, what difference this makes is really difficult to ascertain, right? So I think there's a sense in which people who have a military background are used to taking orders. Maybe they're disciplined, maybe they're punctual, maybe they're sort of neat and tidy and can deal with trouble. Perhaps they're more physically able. Perhaps they respond well in sort of rank-based environments, masculine environments. Perhaps they model certain behaviours to incarcerated populations. Perhaps they have a particular affinity with veterans in custody and can offer a particularly empathetic response there. It's really difficult to ascertain what's going on, and we're at a fairly early stage in that research. But what we are finding is that the sort of stereotypical military terminology which has been used in criminological work towards ex-military personnel, that they're fairly brutal, that a prison that's run under military sort of ways of doing things is by definition lacking in empathy and sympathy and compassion. We're not finding that. We're certainly finding that people who've had a military background are able to show compassion, particularly around bereavement, very aware of things there, and that maybe their military service brings a degree of confidence in dealing with people. Now, it's difficult to know exactly what that confidence is coming from, if it's just coming from the life experience they've had in general, which happen to have been in the military, or whether it's the military experience specifically which brings it. But these are all you know, things that we hope to dig into. But we certainly think there's quite a lot here, and that the fact that the prison has been a place of employment for military leavers for a really long time probably means that there's a degree of influence which has been really sustained and quite untapped, I guess, and not well understood for some time, and we're hoping to provide some insights into this. And I'm reminded of a man I interviewed on the staff at the prison where I was doing the research on visits, and he was working on visits hall, and he was a great big guy, young, he'd been in the forces, he'd served a number of tours, he'd seen combat and so on, and he talked about when he joined the prison service and said that he was looked up and down and said, you know, you're big, you can go on security, you can do cell searches, you can do, you know, restraint and so on, and, you know, he did that and was fine, but he was all the time wanting to work on visits, and wanting to work with families and so on. And he said it took years to overcome the stereotype that as a military person, he must be good at this and couldn't be good at that. And eventually he found his way and was loving that work and doing it well. But I think it was that kind of story that I'd heard in passing through the research I'd been doing up to that point that made me want to look into this in more depth.
Definitely feels like an area that does need to be explored, especially with the kind of like changing staffing group and with a lot of younger individuals and a lot less ex-military, ex-forces personnel. But I have to say I'm not surprised that you're getting that kind of data, because when our unit opened, most of the staff would have fallen into that group of having previously served in the armed forces, and the staff in the unit have, you know, been viewed disparagingly by staff in other parts of the prison for being care bears, being too soft, being compassionate. And actually, you know, my experience of them has been people who've been incredibly caring in how they performed their role and really having a lot of empathy for the people that they were charged with looking after.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're increasingly being struck by sort of the lack of or our own need to fully understand what the military is and what how the military has changed over time, what its values are and how it's operated, and I suppose to increasingly challenge those stereotypical views of what the military and the people who work in it must be. Because of what we think the military is, and I'm sure that there's a lot more that we need to learn, both, you know, me and in general researchers in this field.
It's really interesting, and I wonder if there's a link also with the police, because I've always been impressed by how police people are able to manage difficult situations with apparently great confidence. I used to do quite a lot of work with police people. And was struck by that, and of course a bit of me thinks, well, that is what they're trained to do, that is the role, but there must be more to it as well, and I guess you're uncovering that.
Yeah, so I've been really interested to read the work of Ben Crewe and colleagues over the last few years, particularly on prison staff cultures, which is not something that obviously I've worked on in the past, being, you know, primarily interested in spaces, but he talks a lot about sort of the traditional resistant and the traditional professional staffing model. And increasingly I'm thinking that although maybe in the past ex-military staff might have been leaning towards the resistant model, you know, perhaps lacking empathy, perhaps being focused on security and safety primarily, perhaps having a kind of us and them attitude both towards prisoners and towards senior management, maybe they also lean towards the traditional professional model, which is much more about the legitimate use of power and about sort of being able to use different skills to diffuse tension and having the confidence to sort of to use those skills rather than other skills that they might have, you know, which could be held in reserve. And that, as far as I understand it from Ben's work with his colleagues, people who are incarcerated, who are looked after by people who operate that traditional professional model, feel as if they know where the boundaries are, and they understand that, you know, there will be repercussions if things go wrong, and that prison staff will use those powers when necessary, but only when necessary. And it seems to me that from what we're finding thus far, maybe the ex-military personnel lean quite strongly towards that model of working. Not all of them, of course, you know, everyone's quite different, but perhaps the life experience, perhaps the range of skills, perhaps the sort of having dealt with difficult and trying things in the past might mean that they are more confident to do things in different ways and not resort to kind of the most extreme response straight away.
Thank you.
I believe in your latest research, you're exploring the experience of what it's like to live and work in a Victorian prison. Can you tell us what inspired this research?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is another collaboration with Yvonne Jukes and also with a historian, Matthew Holbrook, at the Birmingham. And we have a fantastic postdoc researcher, Eleanor March, who's just joined us on this project. And essentially, the question really comes out of a bit the research that Yvonne and I were doing on the construction of new prisons and why they were being built as they were and so on, and sort of lurking in the background all the way through in that research project focused on those new prisons was the fact that there were still Victorian prisons operational in the prison estate. And we became really interested in why this was and how these prisons had lasted for so long. And then in conversations with Matt, I become interested in sort of the development of the prison estate over time and its significance. So we hatched this plan for this new research project, which would essentially address that question of, you know, why have the Victorian prisons lasted for so long, the persistence of them, why has it gone on for so long, and what are the implications of that, both for people who live and work in these establishments, for people who need to maintain them, and sort of more broadly about the idea, going back to sort of the public and what they think prisons should be like and what prisons are like, how has the Victorian prison, or has the Victorian prison become kind of the archetypal prison in people's minds, in our collective cultural consciousness, how significant is the Victorian prison? So we're doing a set of research right now. Of course, you know, we hope to be able in the next year or so to go into prisons and do research in them should COVID permit. But so far we've been doing interviews with people who've previously worked and been incarcerated in Victorian prisons, and we're doing the archival work as soon as the archives reopen to understand how these prisons have changed over time. And at the same time, we're speaking to people who've represented the Victorian prison on film, in books and so on, about why they did it, how they did, and how where they got the idea of what the prison looks like from, and obviously, of course, prisoner memoirs written from these buildings and how they talk about them, how they represent them and so on. So that's where we're at with that project. But we think there's something important here about the persistence of these buildings for the estate as a whole, that it makes a difference to have a range of different ages of buildings present in the estate, to have people moving in between them, and that perhaps the Victorian estate carries a certain cachet. Maybe we've heard from some former prison staff that, you know, if you hadn't served in a Victorian, you hadn't really been an officer, you hadn't really done, you know, the job if you hadn't worked in one of these. And also, you know, speaking to people about the significance of things like porridge, you know, for example, in placing an idea of what prison is like into the minds of generations of British people, that perhaps then is quite hard to shift. I mean, that image of the gatehouse and the slamming doors and so on, that's, I think, pretty much burned into most people's minds. And I think, you know, it's hard for me now to think back to before I was doing research on prisons, but I'm sure that if you'd asked me then what I thought a prison looked like, I'd have brought that to mind. And I think it's quite important to understand what the why these buildings are still in operation and what the implications of that are in as wide a sense as we can.
Yeah, my guess is as well, so a bit like with the green space, that some of the kind of like, or the when you were kind of like talking about the visit space, that there would be small nuanced things. So having worked in Leeds prison, which obviously comes into that, you know, you used to feel filthy just walking into the prison. And there's very little ventilation. So when you walked around the prison first thing in the morning, what you got was a massive blast of everyone's morning breath. Whereas working in Whitemore, where there's a lot of fresh air and ventilation, I can only think that the experience of being incarcerated in a Victorian prison is harder than the experience of being incarcerated within a lighter area prison, it feels less grubby and dirty. Just like I say, just literally walking in and out of the prison was unpleasant.
Sure.
Don't know about you, David, your experience of Victorian prisons.
Very similar to yours, the several I've been to. One is impressed by how can they let a place get into this state and still have people living in it sometimes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think all those sentiments resonate with the people that we've talked to thus far. I think what's quite interesting, David, based on what you've just said, is that in looking into the archival data and, you know, the historic record, we found a source from 1921 that said the only reform to which these buildings can be subject is dynamite. So 100 years in the past, we were saying that these prisons were no longer for purpose. And then at various stages over the century, in between then and now, politicians have pledged to close them, haven't done so, pledged it again, haven't done so. And of course, we've closed some, but there's still many, many in operation. And I don't necessarily think that they shouldn't be there, but I think it's important to pose the question and understand kind of how will we know when they reach the end of their operational life? What are the things that we think are red lines, for example? What kind of environment should we not have people in, and how do we define what that is?
It's been a really fascinating conversation, and a few years ago I never would have imagined that I'd be talking shop with somebody from a geography background and to be finding it so insightful and informative. It seems to me there's a lot that other disciplines could gain by having an understanding of carceral geography. Do you think there's enough communication and knowledge sharing between carceral geographers and others that are involved in the justice and health sector?
That's a really good question. I guess I come at an answer from a slightly sideways view, right, in that I think carceral geography could only have happened itself through the spatial turn which has happened in a lot of other disciplines. So, you know, I wouldn't wish to characterise at all that other academic areas which work on prisons are not aware that space matters. They all are, I think, and this I think partly comes about through this notion through the social sciences over the last few decades that space is important. And of course this plays to geographers because we've been thinking this for some time, but I think part of the productive dialogue which has happened, and you know, you can see through my own work of working with criminologists for quite a long time, comes about because there's a growing awareness in those other disciplines that spaces are important and that they influence the well-being of people who live and work in them. So I think there was a precondition which led to productive dialogue between geographers and those other academics. I think at the same time, though, carceral geographers were really aware that we were very, very new to this area. You know, geography is kind of a little bit like a magpie. It likes new, shiny things, and with this was our newest, shiniest thing. But at the same time, being really keenly aware that there's obviously traditions of research in this field from long-standing areas and people who spent their lives working on it, and that what we needed to do is to read and learn and talk with people who've had this long experience. So I suppose we've learnt a lot from criminologists and prison sociologists and psychologists, I guess, about how to talk about these spaces, and there's lots of interdisciplinary conversations and conferences and work which sort of draws on the different perspectives of those different people and hopefully draws expertise from them. So I think maybe those other disciplines are more ready and more naturally able perhaps to communicate the research they do to the people who might be able to use it, and maybe that's partly based on an assumption from the people who use the research that the knowledge they'll gain is most robust and most sort of firmly grounded if it comes from specialists in this area. And you know, of course, there's a lot in that. I guess what I hope is that by doing the best work that we can within carceral geography and trying to be as aware and to read as much as we can of which has been written by researchers who've had a more long-standing engagement with these spaces, we can position the kind of work that we do to be of use and communicate it in a way that makes sense and has benefits for those who might like to understand how these spaces operate. I guess in my own work, in working with criminologists and people in different areas, being asked the question, you know, why does space matter? Being asked a sort of fundamental question that I guess perhaps geographers have stopped asking of one another because we already kind of understand this on a very implicit level, has definitely challenged me to explain my rationale, and has challenged me to say, you know, I think it matters for these reasons, rather than just kind of blithely going on doing what I do. So I appreciate those challenging conversations of being asked that question, because I think it helps to sharpen the focus of the work that we all do.
So finally, Dominique, we always like to finish our interviews by asking guests how to describe how they keep themselves feeling soothed and nourished. Are you mainly reliant on connection with nature? And what else have you found valuable for keeping yourself sustained and resilient?
I think you've hit on it. Nature, my dog, and the combination of those two things, and walking him in green spaces. I've really enjoyed over this last year gardening, growing things really badly. You know, my vegetables were terrible, but I tried, and it was nice trying. I've enjoyed that nurturing, I guess, process, and getting out and having contact with green spaces and cooking. I really like that too. So I don't think I've got any particularly brilliant insights here. It's the same thing that I think most people have done this past year.
Thank you. That was a really fascinating interview. I've really enjoyed that conversation. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for your time. It's been nice to talk about it. Thank you.
It's been really great talking with you. And my idea of the perfect multidisciplinary team just gets bigger and bigger. and I'm already beginning to think about how one could have a sort of hub and spoke approach to a multidisciplinary team, which include you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that was a really fascinating discussion. I mean, I enjoyed that anyway, because I think we were talking about the role of nature, and I think I personally find that quite uplifting, and I think it's really nice to be talking about something that is well-being enhancing in these conversations about criminal justice system, because I think quite often we end up discussing some of the barriers. But it really made me think about the role of carceral geography and whether there's scope for more involvement. And I don't know about you, David, but I was involved in looking at plans for a new build for a swanky rebuild of a psychiatric hospital, and as somebody who's got no knowledge or background in architectural design and planning, and having to make sense of plans and whether they were going to work well for the patients. And in actually, although the building was beautiful in terms of very light and airy, it didn't lend itself acoustically to creating a sense of warmth and community. And just thinking about getting carceral geographers involved in the planning of public spaces could mean that spaces end up being much more therapeutically beneficial. But we kind of, like, perhaps arrogantly assume that we don't need to look further than the same old professionals that are working within these services at times, and how much more enriched services would be if they were to draw on this knowledge from different groups of people.
Yeah, very well put. I thought Dominique was a really warm character, and she must be a great teacher to have. It made me think about the role of expertise, and it reminded me of when I started a new job in East London. I had a very kind of a grand title, which I think, if I can remember it all, was something like consultant psychotherapist in forensic psychiatry, which is a bit of a mouthful. And the administrator called me into his office one day and said, you know what an expert is, don't you? It's somebody who knows more and more about less and less. And that doesn't mean anything here. And then he proceeded to put me in my place. But I thought with
the nice welcome.
Yes, I thought she was a real expert. And the way that she talked about the visit rooms, talked about those tables with their tiny plastic chairs, how that forced people to feel uncomfortable, how they couldn't lean forward. I thought that's coming into something with the expert eye. That's the real meaning of the expert. Of course, my administrator guy happened to be right about me, but In Dominique, we met a true expert.
Absolutely, and I think the humility that went with that expertise and the real passion, but there's also something about freshness and bringing a fresh perspective in. So, you know, we've all seen those tables and perhaps thought, you know, they're not lending themselves to it, but not then allowing that to sink in and percolate a bit more and make more of it in a way that she was able to do, thinking with her geographer's brain.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music. You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.